Navy is our outer line of defense. Almost the very minute that this administration came into office 7.5 years ago, we began to build the Navy up, to build a bigger Navy. And in those 7 years, we have raised the total of 193 ships in commission to 337 ships in commission today. And in addition to that, we have 119 more ships that are actually under construction today. In those 7 years, we raised the personnel of our Navy from 106,000 to 210,000 today. You good people here in Boston know of the enormous increase of productive work in your Boston Navy Yard. And that's only one of many Navy Yards, one of the best. There are now six times as many men employed in all of our Navy Yards as there were back there in 33. And the private shipbuilding yards are also humming with activity, building ships for our Navy and also for that new expanding merchant marine of ours. Well, you know, and I know, and they know out on the farms of the Middle West that the construction of this Navy has been a monumental job. And in spite of what some campaign orators may tell you, you cannot buy a battleship from a mail order catalog. We've not only added ships and men to the Navy, we've enormously increased the effectiveness of naval bases in those outlying territories of ours in the Atlantic and the Pacific. For our objective is to keep any potential attacker as far from our continental shores as we possibly can. And you here in New England know well and visualize it. In the past 2 months, your government has acquired new naval and air bases in British territory in the Atlantic Ocean, extending all the way from Newfoundland on the north to that part of South America where the Atlantic Ocean begins to narrow with Africa not far away. And so I repeat to you, our objective is to keep any potential attacker as far from our continental shores as we possibly can. That's the record. The record of the growth of our Navy. In 1933, a weak Navy. In 1940, a strong Navy. Sideline critics may cop in a political campaign, but Americans are mighty proud of that record, and Americans will put their country first and partisanship second. Go back to the old congressional record. Speaking of partisanship, I remind you, when the Naval Expansion Bill came up in 1938, the vast majority of Republican members of the Congress voted against building any more battleships. What kind of political shenanigans are those? Can we trust those people with national defense. Next, take up the army under normal conditions. We have no need for a vast army in this country. But you and I know that unprecedented dangers require unprecedented action to guard the peace of America against unprecedented threats. Since that day, a little over a year ago, when Poland was invaded, we have more than doubled the size of our regular army, adding to this the federalized National Guardsmen. Our armed land forces now equal more than 436,000 enlisted men. And yet there are armies overseas that run to 4, 5, and 6 million men. The officers and men of this army of ours, the regular army and the National Guard, I say are the finest in the world. And they will be, as you know, the nucleus for the training of the young men who are being called under the Selective Service Act. 800,000 of them in the course of this year, out of nearly 17 million registered. In other words, a little less than 5% of the total registration. General Marshall said to me the other day that the task of training those young men is for the Army a profound privilege. Campaign orators seek to tear down the morale of the American people when they make false statements about the Army's equipment. I say to you that we are supplying our army with the best fighting equipment in all the world. Yes, the Army and the Defense Commission are getting things done at speed and efficiency. More than $8 billion of contracts for defense have been let in the past few months. And I'm afraid that those campaign orators will pretty soon, if they keep on much further, they'll pretty soon be under the painful necessity of coming down to Washington later on and eating their words. But I can't help but feel that the most inexcusable, the most unpatriotic misstatement of fact about our army, a misstatement calculated to worry the mothers of the nation, is the brazen charge that the men called to training will not be properly housed. The plain fact, the provable fact, is that construction on army housing is far ahead of schedule to meet all needs, and that by January 5th next, there will be complete and adequate housing in this nation for 930,000 soldiers. And so I feel that very simply and very honestly, I can give assurance to the mothers and to the fathers of America that each and every one of their boys in training will be well housed and well fed. Throughout that year of training, there will be constant promotion of their health, of their well-being. And while I'm talking to you, fathers and mothers, I give you one more assurance. I have said this before, but I shall say it again and again and again. Your boys are not going to be sent into any foreign war. Going into training to form a force so strong that by its very existence it will keep the threat of war far away from our shores. Yes, the purpose of our defense is defense. The Republican campaign orators who moan and groan about our Army and Navy. They're even more mournful about our strength in the air. But only last year, 1939, the Republicans in the Congress of the United States were voting in favor of reducing appropriations for the Army Air Corps. And so I have to say again, what kind of political shenanigans are these? Can such people be trusted with national defense? I say no. I am stressing, of course, rightly, what every Army and Navy flyer tells us, that what counts most in sustained air power is the productive capacity of our airplane and engine factory. That ought to be almost a first grade lesson. We're determined to attain a production capacity of 50,000 planes a year in the United States. And day by day, we are working and making very rapid progress toward that goal.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force. You are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well trained, well equipped, and battle hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air, and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
I have just left your fighting sons in Korea. They have met all tests there, and I can report to you without reservation, they are splendid in every way. It was my constant effort to preserve them and end this savage conflict honorably and with the least loss of time and a minimum sacrifice of life. Its growing bloodshed has caused me the deepest anguish and anxiety. Those gallant men will remain often in my thoughts and in my prayers always. I am closing my 52 years of military service. When I joined the Army, even before the turn of the century, it was the fulfillment of all my boyish hopes and dreams. The world has turned over many times since I took the oath on the plane at West Point, and the hopes and dreams have long since vanished. But I still remember the refrain of one of the most popular barrack ballads of that day, which proclaimed most proudly that old soldiers never die. They just fade away. And like the old soldier of that ballad, I now close my military career and just fade away. An old soldier who tried to do his duty as God gave him the light to see that duty. Goodbye.